Okay, everyone, so tonight I am going to try to take the meditation in a slightly different direction, see if we can do a meditation on death, and see if we can find out what it feels like to die in a rough way. And if you feel uncomfortable with this at any stage, there's no need to take part. Only if you feel at ease and you feel relaxed about it, is it good to do these kind of things. In any case, we start off every meditation, regardless of what it is, by just giving rise to mindfulness, by finding that ease and relaxation, by just allowing the mind to settle down, and allowing the mindfulness to come up. So just start your meditation as usual, and just finding that relaxed and easy posture where the mind and body are comfortable. It is quite marvelous when the mindfulness starts to arise. It is as if you start to feel in charge of yourself, as if you are regaining control in your life. And this is precisely why this is the starting point for meditation practice, because at that point you can start to guide your mind in the right direction. So always take enough time to allow the mindfulness to arise properly before you go to the meditation object. And now let us try to take the meditation in a different direction. And the purpose of this is almost like to rehearse for the dying experience itself. So you have to make it real, as if it is really happening, and then feel the process as it happens, and see how that makes you feel at the end of the meditation. And if you do it in the right way, it is really only a process of letting go. And actually, in that sense, it is a very useful thing to learn how to do. So start off by imagining yourself on a bed, with a thin mattress. You're lying on your back. And in this room that surrounds the bed, the walls are entirely white. There is no window. The door is closed. And there's nothing of interest in this room. You are lying there, just perfectly comfortable, and you know that you have said your last goodbyes. From now until the point you die, you will not be seeing any other human being. And just lie there for a few moments, and feel what it feels like to know that you have come to the last few hours of your life. And just take note of that feeling for later on. What it feels like to know that you are about to die. Just take note of that, and later on we can discuss the implications of that. But for now, just imagine, continue the process. You are just lying there. There's nothing to do from now until the point you're going to pass away. You're just waiting for the last moment to arrive. You know it's going to be very short. And you're approaching it all the time. And you start to realize that you have to let go of things in your life. The most obvious things you have to let go of are all the possessions in this world. What does it feel like to let go of all the possessions in your life? And you know that the time is approaching closer and closer, and it's becoming more and more obvious that you have to let go of everything. Now is the time to let go of all the people in your life, all your friends, all the acquaintances, anyone who means anything in this life. Now is the time to let go of them, including all your family members, your partner in life, and everyone has to go. In your heart, say your last goodbye to them, wish them well, and let go as part of this process. And as the moment of death becomes closer and closer, it becomes clearer and clearer to you, all the things that you have to abandon. So much of your sense of identity is tied up with this world, who you are in relation to others, your background, your education, your achievements, whatever it is, all of that is tied up with this world. You can't take those things with you into the future. You have to empty it all out. Feel that sense of emptying in outside. Feel that sense of letting go of all those aspects of your identity. It's like you're emptying out your inner life, and only remaining thing is the essence of what you have done in this world. It is such a marvelous thing to empty out all this sense of identity. You start to feel empty, but you feel a wonderful sense of freedom at the same time. It's as if you are liberated from all these limitations. You feel free inside. And this is part of this wonderful process of gradually passing away. Feel that sense of emptiness inside. Feel what it feels like. And then know at the same time that you are approaching the last few breaths of your life. And it is now getting very close to your final moments. And you realize that you have to let go of absolutely everything here. And the last thing that remains now is your physical body here. Now is the time to let go of the physical body here, as if you are almost becoming disembodied at this particular point. And try, if you can, to feel that beautiful sense of lightness, the lightness of leaving everything behind. All the baggage from this life, all of that is gone. There's almost nothing left. A sense of lightness and ease inside. What a wonderful thing that is. See if you can experience some of that beautiful feeling of letting go of so much. And there comes a point in this process where you no longer know whether you are dead or alive. But the marvelous thing is that it doesn't really matter, because all you know is that you feel light and you feel free, as if you have left behind a massive burden and a major problem. And as you feel that sense of liberation and freedom, you start to feel a sense of gratitude. A gratitude for all the people, the whole world, who made it possible to experience such a marvelous moment. You feel a gratitude to the entire planet. See if you can give rise to that sense of marvel and gratitude. And as this marvelous experience unfolds, you feel also the sense of gratitude towards the Dhamma and the Buddha and these wonderful teachings that have allowed you to experience such a wonderful moment. And the whole world, all the Kalyanamitas that have supported you as part of this, you feel this overwhelming sense of gratitude. And the metta arises in you for the whole planet. For everyone has, in a sense, been part of this. And just take a few moments to reflect back on this process and how beautiful it is and how marvelous it is. And just ask yourself, why is anyone afraid of this beautiful process? If it is done well, if it is done in the right way, with the right foundation, there's nothing there to be afraid of. And then, at the very end, just come back to your breath for a few moments. Now, once again, as we come to the very end of the meditation, ask yourself, how do you feel now? And again, ask yourself what the causes of those feelings are. If you feel peaceful, why is that the case? What is the process of peace like? How does it occur?
Being also.
Yeah.
Being missing.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let us come back to the Q&A and see what we have tonight. Okay, number one. Dear Ajahn, should we try to give right attention at all times, and when we don't, open the door of our heart to ourselves as acknowledge, learn and forgive with Megha Metta? Should we try to give right attention at all times? Ideally, yes, because the idea is always to try to live as pure a life as possible. Yeah, the idea is to have maximum amount of morality in your life, to be as kind as you possibly can, both in action, in speech, but also how you think about people, and to be able to always be positive or to have a sense of metta and compassion is quite difficult. And the only way you're really going to be able to succeed with that is if you have a large degree of mindfulness, a large degree of awareness, a large degree of attention as to what is going on. Yeah, and this is kind of really where a lot of Buddhism actually is, in that how we kind of live moment to moment, day to day, year in, year out, and our ability to live in the right way is going to very much dictate our ability to come here and meditate properly wherever it is that we do our meditation practice. So that is really the purpose of wise attention and mindfulness in ordinary life. The purpose should really be to enhance our ability to be kind, to avoid doing the bad things, and even to think kind thoughts to the maximum of our ability. Yeah? And of course, as you say, if sometimes you slip up, which you will do, you're not going to be able to be 100% mindful all the time. It's just it's almost impossible, except maybe if you're an arahant, but it's very hard to do. So you're going to make mistakes. That's okay. The point is not whether we make mistakes or not. The point is whether we are moving in the right direction. That's what really matters. Are we kind of slowly heading in the right direction? If you are, you can feel very satisfied with what you're doing here. Okay. Okay, next one. Dear Ajahn Vamali, thank you for the clear, engaging and wonderful teachings for the past few days. You mentioned today that we should reflect, ponder, investigate, besides meditating. How do I do that? After a sitting meditation session, I continue with the intention of reflecting on a particular issue. How do we reflect wisely without falling into the danger of thinking? How do I know I'm reflecting and not just thinking? I tried writing in a journal but gave up after a while, as I found myself writing about the same problems, issues. So some pointers, please. Thank you. We met up. Okay, so that's a good point. There is an important distinction between just thinking and actually reflecting about something in a more directed way. Yeah, like you have a theme and you stick to that theme, you don't allow the mind to wander all over the place. There is a big distinction there. Just thinking is often kind of lazy. It's like the mind doing its own stuff, going its own way. When you reflect, it's more like you have a particular theme and the mind is directed towards something. So for example, now we were just doing like a death recollection, or a death reflection. And these are the kind of things you can do. Stay with one topic. Think about that. What does it mean to die? What does it imply? Yeah, you just walk back and forth and you very quickly realize that one of the main things about dying is letting go. Yeah, it is a very powerful moment of impermanence and everything has to change. It's a powerful moment of non-self because you can't really control the dying process. it can be, if you're not careful, it can also be a lot of suffering, because wherever there is impermanence, suffering is always very close by, unless you're able to let go in the right way. This is one way of doing this reflection, a very simple kind of Dhamma reflection. Reflection that everything that is dear and pleasing to you in life is going to become otherwise very closely related to the idea of death, but you can broaden it out. You can take a particular theme, if there's a theme in the suttas that you have found was interesting. You can even think about those things. You can even sit down in your room and read some of these suttas. Read them, put them to one side and think, wow, what does this mean for me here? What are the implications of this? And sometimes, not the, perhaps the most theoretical ones, but some of the more practical suttas that we're going to have start to look at a bit more in the next few days. And as you do so, you are developing right view, developing right attitudes, and you're also developing kind of the ability to let go a little bit. Metta meditation can also sometimes involve a little bit of thinking and reflecting. So reflect about how to, kind of sometimes you need to overcome perhaps a little bit of ill will or negativity. And sometimes that needs a little bit of reflection to be able to do that. So this is essentially how you do it. And sometimes you can just walk back and forth and kind of feel what kind of feels like a natural theme to reflect on. What is useful? You can think about things very broadly, like rebirth and karma or whatever. You can think about the problems in being angry or sensuality. You can think about anything really, anything which kind of inspires you or helps you to look at the world in a suitable way, and that kind of brings out the right things. Sometimes all you have to do is just watch your mind. You walk back and forth and watch your mind and see what is going on inside of you. And sometimes you see your mind going to certain places, and what you do is just becoming familiar with where your attachments are, where your problems are. And then you look for the counterpoints. How can I actually counter this in a wholesome way according to Dhamma to eliminate some of these problems? This is like getting some insight into your defilements, into your problems. That is also a very important part of these things. But very often reflection, sometimes if you want a guided reflection, the actual, this is one of the reasons with the sutta readings, you can just take a sutta that inspires you, read a simile that inspires you, and just reflect on that. Then you have a very clear guidance straight from the Buddha, if you like. What does this mean to me? That can often be very meaningful in its own right. So see if that works, and if it doesn't work, then then try again, try until it works. Dear Anjan, thank you for your talk, especially appreciate your patience while answering our questions. You have no qualms about answering some questions over and over again. I'm sorry I did not make it to the interviews as I fell asleep while meditating and woke up 3 hours later. Thank you once again. Okay, I'm very glad to hear that. You are really relaxing, enjoying yourself, not taking things too seriously. Yeah, what a wonderful thing that is. So well done. I'm just kind of chilling out and enjoying yourself. So very, very happy to hear that. Okay. Dimante. We were taught that Prince Siddhartha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya in India. Further, when he was meditating, he was protected by the snake named Mutsalinda during the rainy period. These informations not presented in the given sutta. People still go to Bodh Gaya for the reason. Is it true or false? Please explain. Was the Buddha ever protected by the Naga Mutsalinda? This is the question. Did this really happen or did it not happen? And you're quite right. It is not found in the suttas I was reading out. I think the earliest place it is found is in the Udana. The Udana is in the Kuduka Nikaya. And at the very beginning of the Udana, there's a number of series where the Buddha talks about events that happened after his awakening. And that is where it is found. Once you move into the Udana, you are moving into, I think, slightly more uncertain territory. These are stories that are more uncertain, and they can, again, you know, I like to use, as I mentioned before, the idea of comparative study. You compare the Pali with the Chinese version of these stories, and when you do that, you realize that the Udana is much more unreliable. The stories are more kind of late. They must have come sometime after the Buddha. So whether the Buddha ever was protected by the Naga Muchalinda, I must admit I have my doubts. I'm not so sure about that. It is possible many strange things happen in this world. It's not something you can kind of just dismiss out of hand. But it sounds like something that was developed later on to me. So I would say, I cannot really tell you whether it happened, not obviously, but to me, I think it's more likely to be slightly legendary and mythological rather than to be taken too literally. That's what I would say here. But certainly, Bodhgaya seems to be the place that was called Uruvela in those days, so there is good grounds for thinking that that actually is the right place that the Buddha was awakened there. So, I hope that helps. Okay, dear Ajahn, I love the suttas you are doing. Yay! Thank you for doing Majjhima number 2 the way you did it, linking it up with the 5 khandhas and meditation practice. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I have a question about the last of the 3 fetters, adherence to rules and observances. I think you mentioned precepts. Do you mean the 5 precepts? I thought it normally is explained as adherence to rites and rituals. Thank you very much. We met at times 10. Wow, that's really good. Okay? It is usually explained as adherence to rites and ritual. That is the usual translation, and it is actually a wrong translation. And this was pointed out by Bhikkhu Bodhi a while ago when he translated the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings, into English. He pointed out that it doesn't mean rites and rituals. Sila, bhatta, sila is just sila, yeah? The same word as the word for the 5 precepts, the word for our habits, our character, and all of these kind of things. That is what it refers to. And bhatta, sila, bhatta, it's actually the V becomes a B when it's compounded into one word like that. These are some of the Pali, how the Pali functions. Vata just means like an observance that we're talking about before, something you do. Yeah, you go to the temple every Saturday to burn joss sticks or incense sticks or something like that because you think that's a good thing to do. Yeah, and maybe it is a good thing to do depending on how you do it a little bit. So these are the vattas, the observances. Of course, part of those observances can be rituals, but it doesn't have to be rituals in any ordinary sense. But it certainly means sila in the sense of morality, yeah? You don't adhere to those things. And only, again, only happens when you become the Sri Mentor. Yeah? Okay. Dear Ajahn, can we believe in miracles? How do you explain things that happen in life for no reason? Thank you, with metta. Things that happen in life for no reason. Are you sure that there's absolutely no reason? How do you know there is no reason? I would say usually there is a reason. Yeah, one of the things about the suttas, we have in the sutta, sometimes we find some very marvelous and wonderful events, events that certainly are super normal. They're not kind of normal events, so we call them super normal. Don't call them supernatural, because supernatural means outside of nature. Yeah, and that is, from the Buddhist point of view, nothing is outside of nature. Everything is kind of part of the natural order of things. There is no God who stands outside of nature and kind of performs miracles in Buddhism. In fact, the word miracle is a Christian word, and it refers precisely to that. It refers to supernatural events, where something stands outside of nature and then does things that are otherwise impossible. There's nothing like that in Buddhism. But what we do have in Buddhism, we have sometimes the idea that the natural order, the nature of things, actually is much broader than people normally think it is. Especially the mind is considered far more powerful in Buddhism than in most other areas of life, yeah, they don't, most other philosophies or don't actually think about the mind in quite the way we do it in Buddhism. So according to the Buddhist teachings, it is possible to do some rather astonishing things. And maybe this is what you mean by miracles, yeah, the wonders, the marvels that you sometimes can read about in the suttas. But they don't happen for no reason. Yeah, all of these things are caused, they are conditioned, they happen for whatever reason is going on. You know, if you according to the sutta, it's possible to fly through the air. Yeah, it's possible. But it doesn't happen for no reason. It happens because you have developed your mind to the point where you actually have that ability. That's why it happens. I would say that if things happen in your life for no reason, I would suggest look a little bit deeper. Yeah, and if you look a little bit deeper, you should be able to find some reason for why things have happened. It's never going to be completely random, completely just popping out of nowhere, as if it's as if God or something kind of bang created it. Dear Ajahn, please, there is no need to apologize for the more theoretical parts of the suttas. Okay, I find it all very interesting and intellectually stimulating, and that's coming from someone who has never even heard of a sutta before coming on this retreat, so thank you. Wow, that's pretty cool, so you're pretty taking this on board as you go along, that's wonderful. P.S. Could you share with us a story of one of your own profound meditation experiences? The Buddha is very inspiring, but it's nice to hear a personal story from someone who's right here in the room with us. The best stories I hear, the best stories I hear are always from Ajahn Brahm. I don't really like to. You can't really talk about your own experience as a monk, and you should probably not talk too much about other monks' experiences either. But Ajahn Brahm is one of these great meditators who has all these kind of stories, and one of one of the nice stories about Ajahn Brahm, and it shows you how you can kind of get meditation at almost any time. This is what this story shows, says is that this was kind of during a rains retreat a number of years ago, kind of his meditation was going well and all of this, and then in the middle of the night he was dreaming, and as he was dreaming in the middle of the night, he met this monk that he respected a lot in this dream, and when he met this monk in the middle of the dream, he bowed down to him, and as he bowed down to this monk in the dream, the nimitta becomes so bright that bang, he woke up straight away, and meditation, boof, took off like that. So you can, if your mind is really pure and really powerful, you can dream about nimittas, and then you wake up because the bliss is so powerful, and then your meditation just, woof, goes off like that. This is Ajahn Brahm, Not many people quite like that, but there are some people who have this incredible abilities in samadhi. So this is kind of a wonderful experience, isn't it, when these things happen. There are many, many other stories about Ajahn Brahm that, as a monk, but I feel very uncomfortable talking too much about these things. This is kind of as far as I'm willing to go. I go beyond that, Ajahn Brahm might tell me off in a really bad way. I don't really want to be told off by Ajahn Brahm, So, Akaliko, you're sworn to silence, Okay. Okay. No, that's good. So, just to give you a little bit of an inkling, what can happen with when your mind is really developed. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I am keen to know the content of a moment of consciousness. Does it involve any factors we have learned so far? The content of a moment of consciousness. Well, the point is really that this idea of moments of consciousness, this is really an Abhidhamma idea. The Abhidhamma, it takes the world and kind of divides it up into the most minute particles possible. So every moment, every second there's a billion moments of consciousness or something like that. It's very kind of theoretical, it's a very kind of philosophical construct. And whereas in reality, consciousness is different. Consciousness is more like continuous, For example, if your samadhi starts to get better, you feel a kind of stable bliss sometimes, a stable ability to be with the breath at the very least. But what I meant by consciousness being unstable and changing is that in ordinary waking experience, like now, yeah, you see things, you hear things, and then there is the mind in the middle there that makes sense of all of that. So as you hear and see at the same time, it's not actually happening at the same time. Yeah, you see a little bit, you hear a little bit, and then the mind goes in there a little bit, and all of this happens incredibly fast. So you are unable to disentangle this from each other. But if your mindfulness is very powerful, and you're really, really powerful, you're able to see each kind of stage, yeah, seeing, hearing, mind, etc. You're able to see all of that. And when you see that, you see the discontinuity of consciousness, and you understand that consciousness is not a solid entity. It is a built up of individual elements, yeah, that are completely separate from each other. This is what you can see, but it takes very powerful samadhi to be able to do so. Obviously, you have to have a very, very powerful mind to be able to do that. That is when what I meant before by saying that consciousness is not solid. It is part, has different moments to it. So I hope I'm not sure if that is exactly what you're asking, but if it isn't, please try again tomorrow and we'll see what happens. Dear Ajahn, could you kindly explain a bit more about the Bodhisattva entering the first jhana under the rose apple tree here? This happened when he was still very young and had no exposure to meditation. Could it have been a memory from a past life that made him seek meditation? Yes, I think that's quite likely. Obviously, there is some evidence that the Buddha may have been an ascetic under the previous Buddha. If you read the sutta called the Gatikara Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings, number 82, is it 82, 81, 82, I think 82, Gatikara Sutta is a story of how the Buddha Gautama, before he was a Buddha, he was a disciple of Buddha Kassapa. Yeah, so maybe that happened, and if that happened, he probably would have practiced meditation, so he would have been used to that idea, and then in this life it would have happened spontaneously, probably as part of a memory or something like that. And could it be that memory vanished afterwards, as happens with some children? Indeed, that's exactly right. So the memory would not have been there, but the imprint in the mind was there. So he would have kind of spontaneously sat down and gone into a jhana, because that was a inclination of the mind that he had built up in the previous life. So, yeah? P.S. But luckily for us, he remembered it again about 30 years later. Yeah, that's exactly right. Maybe not 30, maybe... How old would have been? It may have been kind of, maybe he was about 8 or 10 or so, and then at 35 he became enlightened, maybe around 30 years later, you're probably right, maybe a little bit less, but anyway, yes, we have to kind of do the mathematics and sort it all out. Okay, so next one. Dear Ajahn, what is actually the meaning of life? Thank you. The meaning of life, yeah. So the meaning of life, to understand the meaning of life, what you have to do is you have to look inside of yourself. Look into your own psychology, look into your own mind. And what is it that drives you on in this life? Where are you always trying to go? You see that there is something which drives us onwards all the time, yeah? We always have a vision of the future, that somewhere we are trying to go all the time. And the thing that drives us is craving, yeah? Craving wants us to move to something else. Where does craving want us to go? And where craving wants us to go, if you look at craving, it tells us if you get these things, if you get this sorted out, you get everything the right way, you will be happy. You will be content, yeah? So the meaning of life is to satisfy that drive which always is driving us somewhere, moving you towards something, but actually never getting there. And this is the problem. We have this drive to find contentment, find happiness, find satisfaction in life, but by following the craving, it never actually works out. So that is where the spiritual path comes in, because the spiritual path actually enables you to access that contentment, that satisfaction, but in a very different way from what you thought. Instead of following your craving, you start to find that satisfaction somewhere else, where? Well, we find it, first of all, by living with kindness, living in a good way, avoiding doing bad things. And then eventually, when you have built that up properly, then your meditation starts to work. And that is where you find that satisfaction. And this is why I was saying yesterday, you come to a point in your meditation where you feel 100% satisfied. When you are 100% satisfied, there is nothing more to be done. Yeah, you realize that that thing, that craving was telling you all the time, go there, do this, do that, then you will be satisfied. You realize you actually have found that point simply by sitting down, by closing your eyes, following your breath, giving rise to the piti sukha, the happiness and joy, and suddenly there's nothing more to be done. If you have found what craving wanted you to do all the time, it means there's nothing more to do. If there's nothing more to do, you have found the answer to the meaning of life. Yeah? You have found that thing that you're always searching for. Think about it, because it's not obvious. It is not very, maybe not very clear. On the one hand, I think it is very obvious, but if you hear this for the first time, it may not be obvious. But that actually is the meaning of life. The moment you are like a solid rock, and there's nothing more to do, you don't want to do anything more, because you feel completely blissed out. You're absolutely content. There's nothing to move you anywhere anymore. That means you have found the meaning of life. That's it. The end has arrived. Yeah, and this is what the Buddha's teaching actually promises you. First of all, you find that meaning through the ordinary meditation practice, the samadhi, the stillness, and all of those things. And then you realize that even that isn't quite enough. Why? Because you lose that stillness after a while. And that is where the insight comes in, the wisdom faculty. You understand that even those powerful states of bliss, you have to abandon them. And when you abandon those, that is when you find the final peace, the ultimate meaning of life, where there's nothing more to be done. You're finished with everything. That is what it's like to be an arahant, a fully awakened being. Nothing more to do. All you do is just chilling all the time, in bliss, being happy. Isn't that kind of really nice? All you do is just go into jhanas every now and again, your life's journey is complete. You have found the highest meaning of existence. That's arahantship, what that is all about. All you are is a blob of happiness wandering around the world. Kind of nice, isn't it? Okay. Dear Ajahn, is it fair to say that we often have different experiences in practice and we usually make a conclusion, assumption from them when something not right when compared with others? Yes, indeed. And I think I'm not 100% sure what you're trying to ask, but I think something about comparing yourself with others, and then we draw conclusions from that. We look at other people and we think, they may have something, and we draw all kind of wrong conclusions from how we compare ourselves with others. And I think that's a very good idea, a very, very truthful statement. It's actually a bad idea to compare ourselves with others. Sometimes we think that other people are happy and we are miserable, or we think that other people are miserable and we are happy, and we get it all wrong. We don't really understand what is going on. So don't forget about comparing yourself with others. When you come to the spiritual path, there's only one thing that you're trying to do, and that is to develop yourself. It doesn't matter what everyone else does. Sometimes people get competitive on the spiritual path, who can sit the longest. Please never do that. It's not about who can sit the longest. I know Ajahn Brahm sometimes jokes about these things. He has some kind of fun and games, but actually we don't do that at the monastery. So please don't do it either, because it really is a big nuisance. Imagine all the pain you're going to feel and all this kind of stuff if you try to compete with other people. So never compete with anyone. Never try to be the perfect Buddhist or anything like that. Just enjoy the path and work with it. You have certain problems, certain things you need to deal with. Deal with that and forget about everything else. So that is really the right way. Of course, sometimes other people may have experience that can be useful for you. Sometimes it can be useful to listen to what other people have done. They may say, I overcame anger in this way. Yeah, the Buddha is telling us what he did. Then the Sariputta is telling what he did. And everybody is kind of chiming in a little bit with new ideas. Of course, that can be useful. So it's not that we should never listen to others. But comparing to others and drawing conclusions from that, I fully agree with you, it is not a good idea. Because we're all slightly different. We're all moving to the beat of a different drummer, as you know, American poet or something said 150 years ago or something, Thoreau or whoever it was. So we have to actually look at ourselves, our own five khandhas, and deal with that. Then we're doing the right thing here. If I didn't answer your question, please try again tomorrow. Dear Ajahn Bhamali, I am referring to the present day Bodhgaya, the site where the Buddha achieved supreme enlightenment or awakening. Are the events depicted, such as 1, the Buddha's response to the challenge by Mara with the Bhumi Sparsha sign, Patta, or whatever, it doesn't matter. 2, 7 weeks of meditation around the Mahabodhi tree as a mark of respect to the Mahabodhi mentioned in any of the early texts. Some of these things are mentioned in the fairly early text. You have the idea of the Buddha's response to the challenge of Mara. That is part of that is found in the Sutta Nipata. Sutta Nipata is one of the... some of it is quite very early, some of it not so early. I think the challenge of Mara is probably part of the thing which is not so early. I think that the idea that the Buddha literally was challenged by some super powerful being who was trying to send down his armies, I think that is a literary kind of idea which basically is a metaphor or a simile for the Buddha's inward fight against his own trying to find the path to awakening, dealing with the defilements and all of that kind of thing. I think it is a metaphor for that. When you read the early sutta we just saw the other day, that, I think, is the most accurate explanation for what actually happened. So I think it's all quite nice. It kind of makes for very nice stories when Mara comes with his armies and things. You've seen some of those drawings, they're quite kind of fear-inspiring. Mara looks very, quite evil on those signs, or those paintings or whatever. So it's kind of certainly very entertaining, but not sure if it really is all that useful on the path. The Bhumi Sparsha Mudra, you may have seen the Buddha when he is depicted in the pictures. Sometimes he sits like this, and one of his hands is holding onto the ground like that. This is the Bhumi Sparsha Mudra, when the hand is touching the ground like this. The idea there is that when the Buddha gets awakened, when he finds the final awakening, there's no one to tell. If you are the first person in the world, who are you going to tell? And if you start telling people, they think you are slightly off. They wonder what's going on with you. You kind of like this Ajivaka fellow was telling you about before. He just says, whatever, and he walks off. So there's nobody to tell about this because you're the first one. So the Buddha instead, he says, according to the legend, he takes the earth as his witness. Bhumi Sparsha Mudra. And then, of course, the earth can't really witness anything. The earth is just the earth. So it's another metaphor, another kind of legendary embellishment to kind of make some meaning out of the whole situation, basically. But all of these are later ideas. They're actually not found in the very earliest suttas. And then you have the 7 weeks of meditation around the Mahabodhi tree. That's found in the Udana I mentioned before. At the very beginning of the Udana, the first 5 or 6 or so chapters talks about these 7 days when he was kind of walking back and forth on the walking path. He was sitting down and he was admiring the Bodhi tree, and all of that is actually found there. And as I mentioned before, that too is probably a little bit legendary, a little bit later. There may be some truth to that. I'm not saying it is all made up or anything. Legend and mythology often has a kernel of truth to it. I've been taught this by Ajahn Sujata. He's the one who kind of likes mythology and legends a lot. And so he told me, legends and myths always have a kernel of truth. And I said, yes, sir. And as now I'm repeating that to everyone else. So I'm assuming that's true. If it's not true, it's his fault, not my fault. I'm just going to pass on the back to him. But it makes very good sense, actually. It makes really good sense
that he should say that, and that actually what's going on, because where did this myth and legend come from? Very often they come from some historical event that is then embellished later on, and then you get all these stories and things. And this is true everywhere around the world, in all kind of literary traditions, a very common thing to happen here. Okay. Dear Ajahn Bamali, is there a difference between enlightenment and nibbana? Are they mentioned separately in the suttas? Thank you. So awakening and nibbana, are they the same thing? So awakening is usually like an experience. Yeah, awakening means bang, wow. Yeah, it's like the experience that happens, sambodha. But sometimes awakening can also be used for the continuous experience of the arahant. The arahant is awakened, and the arahant is always awakened, yeah? So in that sense, it is almost exactly the same thing as nibbana. Attaining nibbana means to be extinguished. You have extinguished the defilements inside. And in that sense, awakening, enlightenment, is the same thing as nibbana. So it depends a little bit on the context, how it is used. Sometimes nibbana is also used, I mentioned before, what happens after the arahant dies. It's called the aparisesa nibbana dhatu. Aparisesa means without remainder. And then there's the parisesa nibbana dhatu, which you have nibbana with a remnant left. The five khandhas are still there. But that only occurs in one place in the suttas, in the Ittivuttaka, I think. So apart from that, it's not a very common way of talking about nibbana. But generally speaking, you're quite right. These things are basically the same thing. Two different angles, yeah, of which to understand a certain thing. One focuses on what has disappeared, the extinguishment of suffering, the extinguishment of defilements. The one other one, you focus on what you have awakened to, yeah? You have seen the truth, you have seen non-self, you have seen all of these things. So it's different angles on which to approach the same kind of idea, the same thing here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teaching. My questions are related to the monastic life. Aha! Does that mean that you are heading towards monastic life? Is that what it means? If so, it is very, it's always nice. What I really love about these during retreats and sometimes giving talks, it is actually quite common that people will come up and say, I'm interested in monastic life. Yeah, because people who are interested in monastic life, they come to these kind of events. Yeah, it's kind of obvious. And that is very inspiring when I hear this, because I feel that the monastic life in many ways is, if it is lived well, and it really has to be lived well, of course, but if it is lived well, it is the highway to awakening, the highway to the highest happiness that human beings can attain. And what a wonderful thing it is if we have more monastics in the world. And then you go on that highway, and after you go on that highway for a while, you become another example of a teacher, of someone who can teach others, and then, bring other people in, yeah? And then everybody has access to these marvelous teachings that actually are so helpful in reducing suffering and increasing happiness in the world. Anyway, that's the way I like to see it. I said I would have to do some PR work on the suttas. Yes, that's the PR work. Someone said they were going to help me out, but if they wish, they're certainly very, very welcome to do so. But it is all about kind of, saying this in the right way, getting the Dhamma right, because there's so much inspiring things there, but you have to kind of present it in a way whereby that inspiration comes out. Anyway, number one, is monastic way of living the only way to attain nibbana? The answer to that question is yes and no. Yeah? Is that helpful? The answer to that question is that it is complicated. Yeah, it is not. It isn't either yes and no. It is a mixture of both. So the first thing to understand is that you can go a long way in theory on the Buddhist path as a layperson. You can do a lot of good things. You can purify yourself a lot. In theory, you can become a stream mentor. You can even become a non-returner as a layperson. And that means that Even it means you may not become an arahant in this life, but at the very least you are on the path to arahantship. There is no turning back. Yeah. So basically, you can say, in that sense, yes, you do, in a sense, attain nibbana as a layperson. So it is possible. And for people who already have lots of commitments in lay life, who already have things they can't let go of, whether it's family or whatever it is. Of course, then you do your very best to practice these teachings as a layperson. Yeah? And that's wonderful. And you really can go a long way. If you really are committed and you really do persevere, you actually can go a long way. I have met some very inspiring lay people over the years. And sometimes I think, jeepers, these lay people are better than most monks. Yeah? And that's what a wonderful thing that is, when you see these inspiring examples in all the four assemblies, the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, the lay and both the lay men and lay women. It's so wonderful when you see that. So it is possible, but remember, it's not just about whether it is possible or not, it's also about where it is easier to do it. Yeah, this is also very important. And of course, the whole point of the Buddha to lay down the monastic life is to give you the maximum opportunity, otherwise he wouldn't have laid it down. So monastic life is kind of a tune. If you find a good monastery here, if you find a good place where you find ease, you find a sense of where you can relax, and it works out well for you, there's nothing is better than that for getting onto the highway to Nibbana. Yeah, you can, as Brahm often says, you can choose to walk to Sydney if you like, or you can take the plane. So how often do you walk to Sydney? Not that often, right? So because the plane is just marginally more convenient, so we take that path which is faster. Maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, the comparison there, but anyway, you get the idea. So but also remember that it also depends on your ability to live this life. A monastic life not lived well is worse than a lay life lived well. Yeah, there's no point in becoming a monastic just for the sake of becoming a monastic. If you're going to do it, you have to do it well. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. So that is one way of looking at this. Another way of looking at this is simply to ask, what about becoming an arahant? And when it comes to arahantship, to go to the very end of the path, it seems from the suttas, as far as I can tell, that is exclusive to monastics. It doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen to lay people? Well, because the moment you become an arahant, mentally you are a monastic. Mentally you have given up that world that lay people normally is part of their life. So you kind of become a recluse or an ascetic, if you like, at that point, and you start to live the life of a monastic automatically at that point. So, number two, there are trillions, really trillions of lay people, while there are not many, many monks and nuns. What are the attributes and parami to be in the monastic life? Okay, so there are heaps of lay people compared to the monks and nuns, which is true. Especially in Australia, the number of monks and nuns is not that great. The number of lay people is certainly much greater. Of course, if you travel to many of the Asian countries, there's far more monastics in those countries, like in Thailand. In Sri Lanka there's a bit, but there's far more monastics in Thailand, and even more, I think, in Burma. In Myanmar, there's kind of very large number of monastics still. Because it has been much more closed off from the external world, they have more of the old traditions that are still going in Myanmar. So what are the attributes in parami to be in the monastic life? Well, parami, first of all, is this later idea of parami that you build up to become a Buddha. It's really part of the bodhisattva path. So forget about the idea of paramis. The only attribute, really, is that you check it out. You come to the monastery, you try it for a while, and you see if you like it or not. That's really the only attribute you need. And then you have to be very nice to the monks, so that they are nice, because otherwise you don't get ordained. The monks ordain you. So that's why we treat you as a slave. The first 2 years we treat you as a slave, because we can really take advantage of you, because we know if you're not nice, then we don't ordain you. There is a tiny, tiny bit of truth there, but only a tiny bit. Most of the time, we are nice to the anagarikas and the lay people. So basically, there aren't any qualities. The only the only attribute you require is the ability to live the monastic life. So check it out, yeah? Go to the monastery, try it out, see what happens when you do it. And if you enjoy it, if you think it is good for you, and you like the community, and you feel that, you know, this works, then that is all you really require to become a monastic. You don't have to go very far on the path beforehand. You don't have to be a stream mentor or have samadhi before you go to monastic life. If you have enough faith and confidence to practice this path and live there, that is actually sufficient. Okay, number three. Would you recommend the monastic life to lay people? I would neither recommend it nor not recommend it. It really depends on the person. Please try it out. Yeah, check it out for yourself. See what happens. I would say that if you go to the monastery and you find that you are able to live the monastic life properly, I would really, really recommend it. Because there are some very powerful things about living in the monastic life. And one of those very powerful things is that you are surrounded by the Dhamma all the time. I remember what it was like to be a lay person, yeah, and it's actually very different because you are surrounded by all kind of people who are pulling in all kind of different directions, who do all kind of dodgy and bad things, and who kind of want you to do this and want you to do that. Monastic life is full time. All you're doing is you're doing, either you're doing charity work, yeah, you're helping out. I was just laying pipes over there just last week. I love laying pipes. It's one of my favorite pastimes. This is part of my inheritance from Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, he taught me how to lay pipes. And I really enjoy that, actually. I don't know why, but I enjoy it. I think it's kind of a part of the... As a child, I used to play with Legos. Now I play with pipes. The same kind of thing. Yeah. So you do charity work as a monk. Yeah, all the work you do is pure charity. When I come here to teach a retreat, or when I lay pipes in the monastery, I do it not because anyone is going to pay me for it, but I do it simply because it is required, it is needed, because it helps out, and it builds up my own good qualities. Yeah, when I do things out of kindness and compassion, out of a sense of wanting to help others, and I'm also helping myself at the same time. So you do charity, a lot of charity work as a monastic. Then you are surrounded by the Dhamma all the time. I do translations of suttas. I read suttas. One of the things I love about teaching a retreat, that gives me the opportunity to read the suttas a bit more carefully than I normally do. Yeah, because you have to kind of feel that you know what you're talking about. You can't just sit up here and talk nonsense, yeah? You can, but it's not recommended. And then you do meditation work, yeah? Also, so you do physical work, that is charity work. I don't need to go to the gym. I think going to the gym is a real waste of time, yeah? If you're going to do physical work, make sure it is good merit at the same time, rather than just wasting it by going to the gym. So we do physical work, we do a bit of mental work by learning Pali, reading suttas and things, and then we do meditation. And then you get a beautiful kirti in the forest that is just large enough, nice and secluded, yeah, where you feel that you are by yourself. That is so difficult in lay life. You always have people around you, you have family, you have the house next door. It's very difficult to have a situation where you can spend almost as much time as you like in a small hut in the forest. And once you get used to that, you get attached to that, yeah. You get attached to staying in a kirti. And it's a good attachment. Yeah, remember before I was talking about various kind of attachments. That's a good attachment, to be attached to a kirti in the forest. So you have all these wonderful and marvelous things. And one of the kind of the astonishing things as a monk, and this is kind of one of the really powerful things, is also that you become like a recipient of so much generosity here. Yeah, there you are, you stay in the monastery. People come every day, a large number of people come every day just to bring food to the monastery all the way from Perth to support us. It's such a wonderful thing. You see the best qualities in people coming out at the same time. That is another wonderful thing about being a Buddhist monk. You meet so many nice people, basically. People who support you, people who are kind to you. I was just saying to Venerable Akarika the other day that one of the great things about being a monk is that people treat generally, not always, but 95% of the time, treat you with so much kindness. What a wonderful thing that is, to live a life where people generally treat you with kindness. It is such a marvelous thing, and it's so Not everybody has that situation, but as a monastic you certainly do. Huh? And then people come and they bring food to the monastery, travel all that way to support you. Huh? It's like as Ambram says, yeah, people come, they bring the food to the monastery. After they have served you the food, they wash the dishes, yeah? And at the end of washing the dishes, they give you a donation for the privilege of doing that. Yeah? And it's kind of true. That's exactly how it works. Yeah? And it makes you really, wow, this is such an amazing thing, this kind of whole Buddhist system and how it works. And hopefully, if those people who come to the monastery and they do that, hopefully it gives them some happiness in return for doing that. Then it is really worthwhile. Remember that when you are on retreat here, we have people coming every day on this retreat, yeah? Coming, bringing food, voluntarily, driving all the way from Perth, cooking for 60 people, 65 people, I don't know how many we are here, cooking for all of us, yeah, and then smiling to you when they come here, and then they go back after they go back again. It's pure, voluntary thing. They do it out of the goodness of the heart, paying for all the ingredients. It's absolutely astonishing when you think about it. Where else in the world do you get this kind of thing happening? So there's something about these teachings that are very beautiful and very powerful, and you are privy to that as a monastic, more so than you are as a layperson. And it's very inspiring, it's very uplifting when you see these things coming together like that. And then you have the Kalyanamittas of the monastic life. Yeah, you have people like Ajahn Brahm to hang out with, which is great, right? I must admit, I really love Ajahn Brahm. People, of course, have slightly different attitudes, or slightly different people that they prefer to have as their teacher. Not everybody has the same kind of inclination, perhaps. But I think Ajahn Brahm is one of the really great Buddhist teachers in the world. Basically, just because of how he teaches meditation practice and the genuineness with which it comes out. He is not really a companion. If you're seeking for a companion in the whole, like a friend, Ajahn Brahm is not that kind of person, because he's very aloof. He's very above it all. He doesn't really treat people like a close friend. If you expect Ajahn Brahm to be your friend, you're going to be disappointed. But if what you're looking for is a spiritual teacher who really has that ability, has walks the talk and talks the walk and all of that, he is really quite exceptional. That is my opinion. And this is what you find if you go to a good monastery. You actually find these things in a good monastery. So if you are serious about Buddhist practice, if that is really what you're thinking about, and you are, perhaps you don't have the commitments that block you from living the monastic life, I would certainly encourage you to try it out. Check it out and see what happens. And if it is for you, and you want to become a monk, then you become person number 25 on the waiting list at Bodhinyana Monastery. That is the downside, yeah, unfortunately. If you are Australian, if you have an Australian passport, you are very lucky, because you actually have a good chance of making it. If you haven't got an Australian passport, that is when, waiting list 3 or 4 years right now to be able to come into the monastery. Yeah? That's how bad it is. And people are kind of, so this is how hard it is. When you have a good monastery, it becomes very popular. And that's why they're desperately trying to get to build more kutis. Anyway, that's a long answer to your question, but anyway, hopefully that helps. I get inspired when people want to become monastic, so it's good to give a good answer, I think. Dear Bhante, thanks for your something teachings. I'm not sure, is this a good word or a bad word? It's an adjective, I think that. It's an adverb. I take it to be a good word. I'm sure it is a good word. Thank you for your, I think it's lovely. Lovely teachings. Okay, so that's a very, very good word. It's very inspiring, and I feel so happy. Do you know the reference for a sutta that says to abandon doubt, we need to inquire? Thank you so much. Yes? There is a sutta which goes something like that, that you have to inquire and you have to reflect on the Dhamma to abandon doubt. That is exactly right. I cannot remember the reference for that right now, so I'm going to have to But I shall try to find it for you. Huh? So if you come to me at some stage in the interview or whenever, then hopefully I may have an answer for you. Yeah? So if you are a little bit shy about your question, you can come to me in private and I will give you the, hopefully give you the answer. Okay, dear Ajahn Bamali, I know someone who has an authentic jhana for many years. Ajahn Brahm knows this person very well. He is generous, kind, open-handed, and positive, and meets difficulties in life with a good attitude. But then the other side of his personality is he gets upset easily when things don't go his way. And he really holds on tightly to his own views and opinions. How does it work? The sutras often present the path so beautifully integrated and balanced, but in real cases we seem to be able to allow extreme contradictions within our psyche and personality. The only thing about this person that doesn't follow the Eightfold Path, is right view. He believes in kindness and generosity, but the rest of Buddhism, I'm not sure if he agrees with all of it. Thank you. Have a wonderful night. Okay. It is very complex because we come from very complicated backgrounds. Yeah, some people may have attained jhanas in the past life, perhaps in non-Buddhist traditions. Perhaps they were a Hindu yogi, or perhaps they were even a Christian saint. Yeah, who knows what they were in the past life. So we come to these things from all kind of backgrounds, with all kind of things, with all kind of personality traits. So it actually is very... it gets very complicated, and you can't really kind of pin it down very clearly. So if this person, if he is generally kind and nice, then presumably he has some of those qualities that are required for jhana experience. That he is very, he gets upset easily. That of course does not necessarily fit very well with somebody who was a jhana attainer, because if you have anger easily, it makes it difficult. But again, it's complicated. Maybe he gets upset easily, but maybe he also lets go easily. Yeah, so he's upset for a short time and then he lets go, and then he can attain his meditation again. It's difficult to make any absolute judgments about this. Holds on tightly to his views and opinions. Yeah, that is not such a good thing. Again, it depends on how you do that. I know, for example, with Ajahn Brahm also often has very strong opinions about things. Yeah, and once he has an opinion, you can't budge him. But also, he's also very flexible at the same time. It's a strange mixture. Very strong on the one hand, but if he needs to change, suddenly he can change just like that, and it's completely gone. So you have to be careful when you observe people like that, because it can seem as if they are obstinate or whatever, but maybe it isn't that. Maybe something else going on. So basically I would say that it's just complicated, and you can never really judge anyone. Yeah, sometimes you can see people who may seem very together, and they may be very kind, and they may have many, many good qualities, but actually their meditation isn't all that great. Yeah, this is kind of, it's strange, and the reason again is because they haven't been developing that kindness deeply enough or for long enough to really have a full effect on their personality. Other people may seem grumpy and whatever, and they may be steam enters, yeah? And you think, whoa, what's going on? So the higher you are in terms of attainments, the more further you are on the path. If you are an arahant, that is when the personality really becomes stable, yeah? Because that is where no defilements are possible anymore. So be open, be careful not to be too judgmental, yeah? And that is really the kind of the final thing. You have to judge a little bit, but also have an openness of mind at the same time. Dear Ajahn, at what stage does the body start to disappear, and what stages come before that? Thank you for your teachings. So the body greenly starts to disappear almost from the very beginning. Yeah, when you sit down, the body may be a little bit painful and a little bit kind of agitated, maybe you are a bit tense, maybe all of this. And as you relax and as you make your body comfortable, it is already disappearing a little bit. Yeah, because disappearing just means that you have less awareness of the body. The more at ease the body is, the more disappeared it has become. But the real disappearance of the body only really happens when your samadhi becomes profound. Yeah, when you go into deep samadhi, initially there's only the breath left, and the rest of the body may have almost gone. And then after a while, if you get one of these lights in your meditation, as some people are talking about, very powerful bright light, if you get that, at that point the body starts to become very, very faint. Yeah, sometimes it disappears completely already at that point. But this is a gradual process of the body gradually disappearing. It doesn't happen like that. Suddenly it's there, suddenly it's gone. It's a gradual movement away from the body. And that's why it is not really scary, because it's kind of an easy and natural transition. But it's only when you come to the jhanas that the body is absolutely gone and there's no kind of recourse to it anymore. You can't actually access it anymore. That only happens in the jhana experiences. Dear Ajahn, as a beginner to the four Nikayas, which SNANMNDN do you recommend to us to start with? So this is the Sanghita Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Digha Nikaya, long, middle, connected and numerical discourses. Of these four, I would say that the best one, in my opinion, is the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. They are very broad, they have a lot of information on Dhamma itself, in a very broad categories of Dhamma, all sorts of Dhamma teachings are there, 152 suttas, seen many from different kinds of angles. But apart from the Dhamma teachings that are presented there, and they're presented in full, they're quite long suttas, so you get a very full and complete overview of the Dhamma. But also it has a lot of the suttas about the biographical suttas, about the Buddha. So you get a feeling about the Buddha, who he was, how he interacted with his monks, and that is also an additional delight, if you like, of the Majjhima Nikaya. And it also shows ordinary people, yeah, it shows kings and monks and nuns and all of these things, and how they live and how they work and how they do things. So Majjhima Nikaya is a very rich and I think very useful collection to start with. But what you may want to do, and that is, instead of starting with any of these collections, you can there's two things you can do. One is to get a book called In the Buddha's Words, which is an anthology. It is a collection of suttas from all the various Nikayas, collected together, arranged according to topic, very beautifully done by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who still is the prime translator of the Pali Nikayas into English. So you can do that. That is probably where I would recommend you to start, because it's a very systematic and well explained collection of suttas. In the Buddha's Words is the name of that collection. You get it on Amazon and everywhere on the internet. Another thing you can do is you can now go to suttacentral.net. Yeah? And there you have all the translation available right there on the internet. And there you can find the middle-length sayings are there, and all the other sayings are there, and you can kind of go and easily just read whatever you like. Yeah? You can go randomly, click here, click there, back and forth. If you don't like the sutta, don't read it, go to the next sutta. Yeah? So don't read suttas unless you enjoy it. Go to the one that you like. And everything is in there. It's a brand new translation by Ajahn Sujata, all available on the internet. Quite the language is fairly modern, fairly accessible, not too philosophical. So it's probably a good place to start, I would say. So there you are, a few hints on how to get started. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain the meaning of nama rupa, sankhara and sanskara? Is this one word or not? Thank you. Okay, so I will explain this in brief. Nama rupa, The word nama in Pali is the same word as the word name in English. It actually is the same word. Yeah. Remember that these languages are all related to each other. They're part of the Indo-European language groups. They're all related. So you find the same words. Nama is actually the same word as the English word name. And all the European languages have that particular word because it all comes from the same root. It means name. Rupa means form. And by form we mean, you see forms, yeah, you see shapes, shapes as forms, physical form, all the forms around us, that is form. So nama rupa is used almost exclusively in dependent origination in the sutta, it's hardly found outside of that. So what it refers to, independent origination, are the aspects of mind that are exclusive of consciousness. Because nama rupa is conditioned by consciousness, and consciousness is conditioned by nama rupa, it means that all the aspects of your personality that are not consciousness is roughly what nama rupa is equivalent to. This is a rough idea, and it's much more involved than that, because the question is, why does the Buddha call it nama rupa when he could have called it the four other khandhas, yeah, the four other factors of personality? Why doesn't he just say perception, feeling, sankhara, and rupa? Why does he say nama rupa? What's the deal here? And part of the deal is because he is responding probably to the Brahmanical tradition where they use this word. Part of the deal is that he's trying to say something specific about those five khandhas. A very important part of the khandhas is the naming of ability of things. Yeah, we to make sense of the world, we kind of name the world. Floor, Buddha statue, light, ceiling, all of this. We name it. This is an aspect of perception. This is a very important part of how we make sense of the world around us. So that is one of the reasons why nama is used there, because it is like a word which kind of brings together many of the other faculties of the mind. And then rupa is the physical aspect. Yeah, that's a rough idea. It's exactly why the Buddha uses this is not entirely clear, but that is roughly what it means. And sankhara, this is the same word as sankhara. Sankhara is just the Sanskrit version of that. And this meaning of this word depends on the context. It can mean many different things, but in terms of dependent origination, in terms of the five khandhas, it means the will, choice, yeah, intentional activities. An intentional activity is a choice. You are choosing to do that activity. It means, this is basically what it means. Yeah, so I use my willpower, it's the doer aspect of a person, that is what sankhara is. In other contexts it means different things. For example, you have the famous saying of the Buddha, sabbe sankhara anicca. There, sankhara means all conditioned phenomena. In other words, everything in the world is conditioned. So sabbe sankhara anicca means all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. That's a slightly different meaning here. In other places, sankhara can mean something like force, yeah? So in other words, it is related to the idea of will. Force and will are closely related to each other when we're talking about the mind. So again, similar kind, slightly different, but similar kind of ideas. So that is roughly what it means. So by far the most important meaning is the meaning of sankhara is equivalent to chetana, intention, will, choice, and all that. To Ajahn, suppose all humanity decided to walk the path and eventually became arahants. It would mean the end of the human race because no one would be making babies. Hooray! Yeah, yay! Wow! What a wonderful thing! No more human race means no more suffering, right? That is why it's such a good idea, you see. So it's not a bad thing if there are no babies. Some would consider this a bad thing, but in the quest to the end of suffering, it must truly be very good. You have understood it exactly right. So well done, because this is the kind of question we get a lot. Did the Buddha ever speak of such a possibility? Perhaps every advanced civilization across the universe eventually reaches such a point, allowing itself to die out in a fully enlightened state, and that is why we are yet to discover evidence of super advanced aliens. Thank you very much for your wisdom and guidance. I'm not sure, because the problem is, you look at the advancement of civilization, I'm not sure if the advancement of civilization is always, has anything to do with advancement in morality necessarily, or kindness or meditation, yeah? In one way, I think the ancient India was, in terms of spiritual practice, was perhaps more advanced than we are today. You had lots of arahants, you had lots of people practicing the spiritual path. Today we have greater material wealth. Yes, the world right now is fairly stable perhaps as well. Actually, there's some very bad wars going on as well, of course. But it is not obvious that kind of civilization moving forward equates greater spiritual values or more spiritual advancement. I'm not so sure about that. I doubt very much that you come to a state when everyone becomes arahants. Unfortunately, I wish that that were the case. It would have been really nice, but I don't think so. In fact, there is a sutta where the Buddha is asked, specifically is asked, well, you know, down the track, will the whole world become enlightened, or only half the world, or only a third of the world, or something like that? And you know the Buddha's answer? You know what he says? He remains quiet. That's what he says. He doesn't say anything here. He does not answer that question. And I think the reason why he doesn't answer it is probably because it is really very hard to answer. And he may not actually have had an answer to that question. Because, you know, if you start to think about it, I guess mathematically or whatever you want, there are Buddhas at regular intervals, yeah, every now and again a Buddha arrives in the world. If there is a finite number of beings, presumably there is at least within one world system, there is a finite number of beings, but time is without beginning, that means that there is an infinite number of Buddhas. If there's a finite number of beings, but an infinite number of Buddhas, everyone should have been enlightened a long time ago. It's the only possible conclusion, but that is not the case. So there's something wrong with that outlook. That outlook isn't correct. And exactly what the right outlook is actually very different, difficult to get to terms with and to understand how it actually works. So somehow, maybe there are beings are being created, more beings are coming into existence, so that even no matter how many people get enlightened, there's always new beings arising. That's one possibility. Or that calculation I just mentioned somehow is incomplete or wrong somehow. Maybe there is an infinite number of beings, maybe there is not an infinite number of Buddhas. Who knows what the answer is? It's very, very difficult. But I think the answer in the end of the day is that it's never going to happen that everyone gets enlightened. There's always going to be some people who just don't get it. And that is a part of the problem. Okay. Dear Ajahn, if rebirth causes suffering, what is the consequence if we stop birth rather than rebirth? Hypothetically, if all of us became monks and nuns, or we somehow stopped the male and female relationship in this world, then there would be absolutely no birth, and hence no chance of rebirth. Therefore, this leads to the end of suffering. This sounds silly, but does it make sense? Unfortunately, it does not make sense, because rebirth comes from craving. It doesn't matter, you know, whether you try to make babies or not. That's going to be utterly irrelevant, because if you can't be reborn as a human, you're going to be reborn somewhere else. You're always going to be reborn, because craving is going to drive you on. The craving is really the cause of rebirth. So I would recommend you to have, you know, if you are a good Buddhist and you have a baby, it means that the baby grows up in a good Buddhist family. It's good conditioning, yeah? If you don't have that baby, then someone else will have that baby who may not be such a, you know, a wise person. So sometimes people ask, is it better not to have babies so that people don't have to get reborn? It doesn't work like that. They have to get reborn anyway. The question is where they get reborn. That is really the question. So I'm not suggesting that you should have babies, by the way. I think, you know, I'd be a hypocrite if I suggested that, right? I'm just saying that it's not bad to have a baby in your family if you treat the baby well and you kind of encourage them in wisdom and kindness and all these kind of things. It's a wonderful thing to grow up in a family like that. So growing up in a good Buddhist family, wow, actually, you have a really big head start in life. Number two, if rebirth were to happen, then the world population should always be the same. However, the population keeps increasing. Where do those extra rebirths come from? And this is again this idea in Buddhism that it's not just human beings, there's all kinds of beings according to the Buddhist outlook. Animals are also part of the cycle, yeah? So if you look at the animals in the world, well, they are going down dramatically, and we are not making up for that in terms of humans, because the number of animals is going down much faster. You know, insects are almost, they're saying the insect population has dropped dramatically over the last 30 or 40 years or something. And if the insect population drops, imagine how many insects have been wiped out. It's talking about trillions, yeah, compared to billions of humans. The point is, there's all kinds of rebirths. You can become a ghost, yeah. Again, I wouldn't recommend that, but it can happen, yeah. Unless you live your life well, you might end up as a ghost. Or a deva. Deva loka, it's pretty good. Hi Bhante, where does it say in the suttas, except the Vinaya, that Uttaramudassalamma includes the four jhanas and the Aryan stages? Thank you with lots of gratitude. It says that in some of the suttas, in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, which sutta does it say it in? I think Majjhima Nikaya 66, which is the Lattukkikopama Sutta, the simile of the quail. I think it says there. So check out Majjhima 66. If I got that wrong, then I can only apologize, but my memory can only, there's only so much stuff I can fit into my poor little brain. So, but it's there somewhere. So even if it is not that sutta, it will be in there somewhere. So look for the superhuman attainments, and they go into the index or whatever. If you have that available, we'll search online and you should be able to find it. But try Majjhima 66. It's in there in a few places. Okay, sankhara, volitional formations, intentional activities of the mind. Is it reasonable to identify sankhara in concert with the other mental khandhas and the physical basis, particularly those of consciousness, with the origins of kamma? Yes, sankhara is basically the same as kamma. Yeah, kamma is actually sankhara, that's exactly what it is. The Buddha says in one sutta, he says, chaitana aham kammang vadami, or something like that. It means that it is chaitana that I call kamma, or kamma that I call chaitana. I'm not sure which way around it goes. So in other words, chaitana, intention, the will, the choice, that is what is the essence of what kamma is all about. Because when you make intended choices, that is when you make kamma. Those actions are the ones that count. That is exactly what sankhara is, independent origination and the suttas. Yeah? Sankharas are precisely those intended activities. That's why I like the word intentional activities for sankhara, because sankhara is precisely any action that you do which you have intending, wanting to do, that you choose to do, that is where kamma is being made. Okay, last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teachings. My question is regarding karma. I have heard that there is no injustice in the law of kamma. Is that right? It depends what you mean by justice, because the word justice is a word that, you know, is an English word, and because it is an English word, it has a certain history, a certain baggage, certain definitions. And so if you say justice in English, it has certain implications. And it is not obvious that the justice of the law of kamma is the same as the justice that you find in the English word, usage of the word justice. So you have to be careful how we use words sometimes. What you can say is that kamma always has results, yeah? In other words, there's always a particular law that applies, and that law cannot be broken. What is that law? And that law is that any action that you do with a bad intention must always have a pleasant result, unpleasant result. Oh, that's dangerous territory. Oh, yes. So, if you do a good act, it cannot have a negative outcome. Yeah? If you do a bad act, it cannot have a positive outcome. That is basically the law of karma. But it doesn't mean that the action and the outcome are exactly proportional, because how, what kind of proportion it is and how it works out depends on the rest of your personality. So if you are a very developed person who is generally very kind, you've done a lot of good karma in your life, done all the right things, then you will experience that if you do one bad act, you will experience only a very slight result of that one bad act. If you are already a very bad person, yeah, you're already kind of doing all kind of dodgy stuff in the world, and then you do another bad act, then for that kind of person, that one bad act can have tremendously bad consequences in the future. So it depends on your overall development of your mind, the degree to which there is a retribution. And in that sense, it is different from the justice system. That's why I said you have to be careful with the word justice, because in the human justice system, it's at least in theory, in practice, of course, it's nothing like that, but in theory, if you've done a bad act, then regardless of who you are, you're supposed to get the same punishment, yeah? That's kind of the theory of the modern justice system. It doesn't really work out like that, but at least it is more approximate like that than the laws of karma. So, I hope that makes sense to you then. And so it is roughly right what you're saying. There is a large degree of justice there in how it works out. Number two, can everything, literally everything, be explained by karma? And the answer to that is no. And the Buddha talks about this in the suttas quite in a number of places. He says that there are many different reasons for why we experience the world the way we do it. Remember, karma, what is karma? Karma and karma vipaka. Karma vipaka is the result of karma. Karma is the action. Karma and vipaka show the connection between our intentional actions on the one hand and how we feel the world on the other hand. Yeah? It's a connection between intention and feeling. That is what karma is. But some of our feelings have got nothing to do with karma. That is what the Buddha says. He says that sometimes you get sick, and when you get sick you may feel absolutely miserable. It's got nothing to do with karma. It's not a direct relationship with karma. You may get assaulted. The weather changes, yeah? And this, again, has nothing to do with karma. It has to do with having been born as a human being. If you are born as a human being, you can expect certain things. And many of those things are not related to karma in the past life. The karma, if you like, is the fact that you were born as a human. That is the karma. But what happens within that existence will vary depending on all kinds of circumstances. You can even die young or early. Yeah, even that can be part, in a sense, of part of something that has nothing to do with karma, but perhaps because you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, so because of that you then experience even dying early. What the suttas do say is that if you make bad karma, you can make bad karma that can cause an early death. Yeah, so if you kill many other beings, making bad karma can cause you to die early, but it does not say that just because you die early, you must have made bad karma in the past. You see the difference there? The difference is that certain karma will definitely lead to early death, but not all early deaths are relatable back to bad karma. Yeah, there's an important distinction there, and this helps us to explain things like, you know, the great natural disaster where whole villages are wiped out. Did all those villages or all those people there have bad karma, just happening to have bad karma together? It sounds very strange. It doesn't really make any sense that all those villages have bad karma together. It is much more likely that what happened, some of those villages may have had bad karma, others were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah? They've been born in the human realm. If you are born in the human realm, sometimes you can expect to die early, because that's what happens in the human realm. So everything cannot be explained by karma. And this, I think, is one of the great mistakes that you often hear in popular Buddhism. People ask, oh, what did I do wrong because this is happening to me? You didn't do anything wrong. This is life. Life sometimes is difficult. And this is what you can expect. Not everything is karma. And this is directly from the suttas. Yeah, I'm just quoting the word of the Buddha now. Number three, If that is the case, why do people go to the fortune tellers? Okay, yeah, fortune tellers, I would say do not go to fortune tellers. That is really silly. They will take your money and they may not give you anything in return for that money. So I think people go there because sometimes people are a bit desperate. Yeah, please, my life has been so bad so far. Please tell me that I've got something good happening ahead of me. Don't go to fortune tellers. It's inherently unreliable and inherently useless. Instead, what you should do, if you want good fortune, there's only one thing to do in life, and that is to live well. Yeah, if you live well, guaranteed you will have good fortune, but you really have to go for it. When you are a monk, people ask you for all kinds of things, and very often people ask for a blessing. Yeah, so we give these water blessings, and before I give a water blessing, I always tell people this water blessing only works on one proviso, that you live your life well. Yeah, so have you got a deal? You're going to live well, I give you the blessing. They say yes, okay, blessing. Yeah, yeah, that's how I do the water blessing, because the point is, some of these rituals that we do, we have to give them some meaning. They only have as much meaning as we give them, as we imbue them with. And this is how, that's kind of my try to kind of imbue some of these rituals we have with some more meaning. Anyway, that is all for tonight. So please have a nice night, enjoy, have a good rest again, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādin svākato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namasāmi Sūpatipanno bhagavato sāvakasaṅgho saṅghaṃ namāmi.